If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear debris with the 40-volt jet fan leaf blower. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart. But we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
There are two things that are absolutely true. Grandma loves you, and she would never say no to McDonald's. So treat yourself to a Grandma McFlurry with your order today. It's what Grandma would want. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. From Harry Styles to Taylor Swift, today's pop stars are household names, and their songs known across the globe. But how did people consume popular music in the past? Well, Professor Christopher Marsh and Dr. Angela McShane are part of a new project called the 100 Ballads Project, which has been investigating this very question. They spoke to Charlotte Hodgman about just what made a smash hit in the 17th century and shared some excerpts from ballads of the time, performed and recorded especially for their project.
Angela and Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today. It looks like a fascinating project. I've had great fun going through the website and listening to these ballads that you've been working on. Maybe we can start off perhaps by telling us a little bit about the project and actually what it is.
It's a project to kind of bring to the public 120 hit songs from the 17th century. So a broadside ballad was a sheet song that sold roughly for a penny a piece in marketplaces and alehouses and so on. And so what we've done is sort of gather up information on which of these songs were the most successful at the time. They're regularly kind of used by historians and by literary specialists, a little bit by musicologists, but not so much. So through a very sort of complicated process, we tried to work out which were the sort of top 100 songs, and then we put them all together with digital images of the sheets, because they're sheet songs, on a website. We got in touch with the brilliant Andy Watts and the Carnival Band to help with the recordings. Andy then invited lots of extra singers. So the website kind of presents images, recordings, and then all sorts of sort of contextual information on the songs as well.
And we'll be listening to clips from some of the ballads as we go through the interview. Perhaps we could start off with what was the appeal of ballads? How popular were they in the 17th century? Are they kind of the equivalent of today's, you know, top 40 charts?
They were definitely incredibly popular. And there was also a real sense of fashion about them. So there were a new song would come out, often with a new tune, and that would become really popular. So popular that then other writers would use the same tune to write other songs to it. So it was kind of interesting how these particular tunes came up. They came from different places. I mean, sometimes they came from theatre, sometimes they were quite traditional tunes, sometimes we just don't know where the tune came from. The industry was surprisingly recognisable to us in a way, because it became split into in a sense, two parts. One part were people who would encourage new writers, new songs, publish the new songs. And then another part, which was kind of important for the capitalization of the industry, they would buy the best sellers. So they were like Sony, you know, they would own lots of indies, but then they would own, you know, they would promote the ones that were really going to sell well. So that's a good clue if you want to try and work out what was already popular, because, of course, they don't all survive. You know, the survival of sheets is kind of a miracle when you think how long ago it was. And these are just one sheet of paper. So that's kind of how it worked in terms of the industry and, yeah, fashion.
I mean, if I could just add to that, I definitely think we kind of are looking at the sort of birth of the commercial pop industry here, because it's, you know, it's very commercially organized. It's kind of urban centered. It combines kind of tunes and lyrics and artwork in the same way that CDs and album covers, there's artwork as well as the words. And so it's got all these different bits, and there's a tremendously strong focus on love and sex and relationships. It's all there. I mean, the songs are very different. Some of them are incredibly long for modern audiences. There's one that has 98 verses, so it's the same tune sung 98 times, which you wouldn't get away with nowadays. I think that one takes about 20 minutes to perform. But definitely, I think it's the first sort of commercially organised pop music industry in the country.
There was a law which restricted printing to London. And that had started in the middle of the 16th century and it carried on to the end of the 17th century. That's important because it meant that there was a real homogeneity to the trade. Everybody knew each other that was producing these things. It was easy to become specialised. So that really gave it an enormous boost, I think, because they knew they could make money out of it.
And so you get kind of ballad singers who pick up copies of the sheets in London and then travel around the country selling them in marketplaces. So although the kind of epicenter for ballads was very clearly London, there is a sort of network and a system for moving them around. And then quite a lot of sort of provincial songs or stories then make it. So there's clearly a kind of, you know, there's a dialogue between the provinces and the capital that's played out through these songs.
This is all fascinating. I mean, I've got so many questions around this. What made a good ballad then? What key things did you need to have a hit song, a hit ballad in the 17th century?
I think there's probably two slightly different answers there, because there's two sorts of ballads on the site. There's sort of really long, long-lasting kind of classic ballads, and then the more political short-term hits. So in terms of the longer-term ones, I think the fundamental thing is a really gripping story. I mean, there are really kind of, you know, grand narratives with real kind of high points of passion and tension, and stories about death and stories about tragedy. And I think that's essential to it. But then on top of that, I think, you know, a good tune, something that's easily memorable. I mean, quite a few of them seem to have begun as broadside ballads, printed songs, but then are collected as folk songs like three centuries later. So they make that transition from print into folk song. So they're committed to memory. Yeah, so I think story, tune, sort of performability, and then pictures as well. They lots of them have good little woodcut pictures on them. So I think it's a sort of composite of different things that makes a hit. And just one other thing. I mean, I suppose lots of the narratives are kind of super dramatic, like The Norfolk Gentleman, which tells the story of two abandoned orphans who are neglected and left in the woods, and they die in the woods. It became the folk song, the Babes in the Wood. So it sort of dramatizes something that was familiar to people. I mean, parents would have worried about losing their children, about their children wandering off, about their children being kidnapped, because of course they didn't have any of the systems for trying to kind of trace missing persons. So it takes a kind of common fear, a common preoccupation, and then turns it into this really broad narrative. So I think it has to be sort of relatable in that sense, but then magnified as well.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
There are two things that are absolutely true. Grandma loves you, and she would never say no to McDonald's. So treat yourself to a Grandma McFlurry with your order today. It's what Grandma would want. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
Okay, and we're just going to have a little pause just to listen to a clip of that tune you were just talking about.
Now ponder well, you parents dear, the words which I shall write. A doleful story you shall hear, which time hath brought to light. A gentleman of good account in Norfolk lived of late.
And what sort of other themes would you find in this type of music?
I mean, the areas that I focus on most is the political songs. And by that, we mean that they are songs that are seeking to actually do something political. They want to engage people in politics. They want people to shout about their feelings to do with injustice or whatever. And those songs are very different from the ones that Chris has just described, because for a start, they tend not to have a story, although occasionally they do use an allegorical way of doing things. If you take, for example, a new song, that's Lily Bolero. We all call it Lily Bolero today, so we know the tune, and often people know some of the words to that tune. And that tune was credited with singing James II out of the kingdom, that it was so popular and sung throughout the army, throughout the country, that he couldn't move, you know, for this song, which doesn't say, leave the country, James II. It doesn't do that. What it does is it attacks the Irish, it attacks Catholics, it attacks allegorically, if you like, the things that James had been trying to do, which is to establish people were afraid it was establishing a Catholic regime. So they work slightly differently. And yet some of the key things that Chris has just said are exactly the same. It's got to be a great tune, got to be really singable, got to be short verses that people can grasp, usually a chorus. And actually, that's one of the things that makes it a bit different when you perform one of those songs, because it's not necessarily all on the sheet. So, for example, one of the top songs, the Buckingham Ballad, actually that works much better when you perform it with people. If you repeat the last line with the audience that you have, it really makes that a much more powerful song, because everybody becomes involved and it works really well with the music. So it's kind of interesting how the performance of things really changes the song. You start seeing its power once you start hearing how it works, especially with lots of people.
Okay, well, let's just listen to a clip of that one that you just mentioned.
A wondrous tale I will relate, the like was never told you, of Englishmen that England hate, the town of Boxers sold you. To serve in Parliament they chose two men, I fear to name them, for if I did you would suppose I told a lie to shame them.
I mean, in terms of the themes covered, I think the strongest theme throughout them all is sort of courtship, romantic relations, gender relations, sexual relations. Some of these are kind of light and lewd, like the Nightingale song is one of my favourites. It's a soldier seducing a maiden in the fields, and the sound of the nightingale singing serves as a euphemism for the woman's sexual pleasure. So when she feels satisfied, she suddenly hears the nightingale singing. So it's kind of a little bit rude, a little bit bawdy, but lots of them are much, much darker than that. Like, they're really kind of torturous stories about women who become pregnant and are deserted by the man. Again, it's that thing about relatability, about kind of common fears being kind of magnified and dramatized. And then, so lots of them are about love. There are lots of religious songs. I mean, I suppose that's one thing that would be different from the mainstream chart today. There are sort of mainstream mega hits that last for decades that are Bible stories or kind of moral instruction. There's lots of history as well. They clearly had a kind of fascination with a kind of vague idea of a sort of distant past, which is all a bit Game of Thrones. Guy of Warwick kind of killing dragons as he travels around the world, or two noblemen fighting out a battle in the song about Chevy Chase. And the number one ballad is basically the story of Dido and Aeneas, kind of written for a new age. And then there's a fair amount of humour as well. I mean, Angela was talking about the political songs. I mean, my personal favourite of those is The Rare Virtue of an Orange, which is kind of written in the patter of a street seller who's trying to sell oranges to people. So he's kind of saying, buy these oranges, they're great, they're juicy. But it's issued in 1688, and everyone knows what he's actually talking about is welcoming William of Orange to the country. So it kind of takes a fruit salesman, but it's an intensely political song. And I think the humour in that must have been fantastic at the time.
Good people, come buy the fruit that I cry, that now is in season, the winter is nigh. 'Twill do you all good and sweeten your blood. I'm sure it'll please when you once understood 'tis an orange. Its cordial juice does much vigour produce. I may well recommend it to every man's use. Though some it quite chills and with fear almost kills, yet certain each healthy man benefit feels by an orange.
And the rumour as well, because that's one of the songs that actually rumours that the warming pan baby, you know, was smuggled in. So this is James II's son that's been born, you know, is actually the son of a tiler, it says, and he was smuggled in by the midwife. So they managed to get lots of really, really subversive stuff into that song. But another theme I love is all the feisty women. So there's some serious feisty women. And one of the brilliant songs I love is The Crafty Miss. So she is a criminal. She's a horse thief. You can be hung for that. That's a really serious crime. There was a lot of horse thieving going on in early modern England. So she's stolen a horse, it's not a great horse. She runs into this excise man. Everybody hates the tax man. He's a tax man, he taxes alcohol. And he tries to seduce her. Of course, he doesn't realise that he's going to be on the losing, the losing end of this one. So she says, yeah, you know, yeah, you can take me for a drink, everything like this. And then he tells the landlord, we're married. And off he takes her to the room. We don't know what happens in the room, but we can guess. She gets up. He's left all his tax collection with the landlord. So she goes down. She says, my husband's told me to pick up all the taxes. I've got to take them to the office. And early modern marriage, that is, you know, you're married, you are like one. So the landlord doesn't question it. He gives it to her. She steals his horse, much better horse than hers. And off she goes. You know, it's just, and his whole life is ruined because, first of all, of course, he's going to be imprisoned and possibly hung because he's got, you know, he's lost all this government money. Secondly, his marriage is over because he then has to tell the story of what's happened. He ends up very sad figure at the end. Well, I don't know. I took a certain pleasure in that one. It's also a great song.
I mean, I think we have to listen to a clip of that now, don't we?
Oh, yeah, that is a good one. She is good.
An excise man so fine rode into the county of Kent, and there he received much corn. For that very purpose he went. He met with a jolly brave miss. Her beauty was fair to behold, but she gave a Judas kiss and showed him a trick for his gold. She rode on a bonny brave mare, he rid on a gelding or so, he whispered a word in her ear, straightway to an inn they did go. He was of a pretty condition, he called her the joy of his life, and then without any suspicion they passed it for husband and wife.
I think it's interesting that when we're asked to talk about the project, we both are kind of drawn towards the lighter and the more kind of humorous songs, because we sort of feel like those are going to be the ones that are going to engage people. But actually, there's a lot of kind of darkness and there's a lot of death in these songs. And one time on an Idle Sunday, I tried to count up the number of bodies in the 120 ballads. And there's actually 3,884 dead people in the ballads, which is a pretty extraordinary figure. I mean, some of those are battle scenes, so that kind of pushes the numbers up. But there really is a kind of high death toll. So there was really clearly a taste for death and for tragedy that runs through these songs, really.
But I have to say that my favourite song, I mean, so this is my absolute favourite, is about a death. It's the death of a teenage woman, teenage girl, who is the daughter of Charles I. It's called Lamenting Lady's Last Farewell. And that was such a super hit. It went on through the whole of the next century. And ultimately, Victoria, Queen Victoria, created a tomb for this girl who was not recognised when she died, because at the time she was a political threat, because she dies in 1650 during the Republic. And it's the most beautiful song, beautifully performed. I love that song. I don't think anyone, doesn't matter whether it's the 21st century or the 17th century, I defy anybody not to just think that's a fantastic, incredibly sad song.
Well, I was going to ask you both which was your favourite ballad, so we'll take yours now, Angela, and listen to a little bit of that song then.
Mournful Melpomene, assist my quill, that I may pensively now make my will. Guide thou my hand to write and senses to indite a lady's last good night. Oh, pity me, I that was nobly born hither am sent, like to a wretch forlorn here to lament. In this most strange exile here to remain a while, till heaven be pleased to smile and send for me.
One thing I was wondering when I was sort of reading up on the project was how many people would have actually been able to read the lyrics to these. So you're saying that people would come and they would pay a penny and they would take their sheet music away. Firstly, was it music that they were reading for the tune? And also, would they have actually been able to read the words on the sheet?
That's a really interesting question. Historians have put a lot of effort into measuring literacy levels. And I think that about 30%, roughly a third of men could sign their names in the middle of the 17th century. But an interesting thing is that in the early modern period, reading was taught before writing in schools. So statistics that are based on how many people could sign their names probably massively underestimate the numbers of people who could, you know, struggle their way through a ballad, who had a little bit of kind of reading ability. So perhaps more people could read than we think. And then, of course, the other thing with ballads is because they're performed, because it's a performance text, you don't actually have to be able to read in order to engage with the ballad. You can hear it, you can memorise it, you can even possess it, look at the pictures, pin it up, and then get a friend who comes around to read it out to you if you don't remember things. So, I mean, they're a fascinating source because they connect oral culture and literate culture in a way that perhaps no other source material does. You know, they're both one and the other at the same time. And then, Charlie, you also asked about the music. I mean, hardly any of them have printed music on, because, I mean, we can't measure musical literacy, but it was probably incredibly, incredibly low. So there wasn't much point putting tunes on most of the ballads. So what the sheets do is say, you know, here's the text, and it's to be sung to the tune of Fortune My Foe or Flying Fame or whatever it might be. And a lot of the time, these were tunes that were already well known. So people knew the tune, and then they fit the new text to a tune that they already know. Or if the tune was a brand new tune, the idea was you learnt it from the ballad singer. The ballad singer taught you the tune, and then you carried it off. So you didn't need to read music, and you didn't need to be able to read text in order to engage with ballads. They send out waves in all sorts of ways, I think.
I mean, it's also worth thinking about. So an area I work on a lot is the publishing trade and how these things are distributed and who actually buys them. So I've been spending a lot of time trying to put them in people's hands. But I think you also need to think about how many were really printed. And when a ballad came out, they very rarely printed more than 500 at a time. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, they're not allowed to, for one thing, because it's considered a bit of a waste of paper. So I've been thinking about how many of these are actually really bought by the people that are going to perform them. So how many people have their own? And is that really necessary? Because it seems to me that an awful lot of them are bought by people who are going to put them up in there, in alehouses, and they're going to put them up in taverns, or they're going to be actually seeing them as performers. Because it doesn't add up, you know, the numbers of people that can sing these things. So performance is absolutely key to people knowing these things. And then people's memories of songs, incredible. So whereas today we're moaning about people having a, you know, attention span of about 30 seconds or something, people could sing these songs from memory. These enormous songs. It's astonishing. I think it's worth also remembering that everybody loves these songs. You know, Charles I knows about Robin Hood songs. He talks about them when he's sort of like having a row with Parliament. So huge numbers of people really love them. So it's not just that members of the gentry collect them. That's why we know about a lot of these songs. Actually, they're really much loved and they move up and down the social scale. So I think the sheer scale of this and how people pick it up is quite hard to really grasp definitely, you know, as historians like to, with lots of evidence. But there is quite a bit out there.
But it is interesting that in the upper levels of society, so highly educated, highly literate people, there's also a trope in which you kind of speak about ballads as sort of the literature of the streets, the literature of the ordinary people, the kind of most lowly, despicable form of literature that nobody takes really seriously. And the ballad singers are all criminals. So that runs through drama, it runs through elite commentary. But at the same time, it is often sometimes the same people who are sort of absorbing and disseminating this kind of stuff are also kind of collecting. So it's a sort of love-hate relationship that the gentry have to pretend that ballads are beneath them. But at the same time, clearly they are consumers.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about the ballad singers themselves and how they were seen.
There are definitely some very well-known ballad singers. So my favourite guy is a guy called Methuselah Flowers. And he does
name.
A tour. Yes, exactly. I mean, love him already. You know, he's the Jethro Tull of the period. So actually you can track him from Tewkesbury down into the near London and also across to Oxford. So I managed to find him a number of places, thankfully, because he has this great name. So that really helps. And we also find him because he gets imprisoned a couple of times because, of course, what happens is a really good singer will attract lots of people. And yes, crime often happens. Pickpocketing and all that sort of thing definitely happens because obviously, you know, people are distracted. But how good you must be to attract a crowd big enough to frighten the authorities so that that's why he's arrested, because he's gathered people together. So there are a few names of ballad singers that we definitely know. Henry Jones is another one from Oxford, and there are a few others as well. But most of them suffer the outrageous fortune of just loving music, performing for a living, and being arrested every time they fall foul of the authorities, you know. So they're sort of semi-treated like beggars if they just happen to walk into the wrong situation. But this is also true of actors. I mean, you've got travelling actors. There's a whole stream of travelling performers, amongst which, you know, are singers, ballad singers, bands, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, ballad singers had a terrible reputation. And one of the kind of tropes that runs through contemporary drama and literature is this idea that ballad singers work with pickpockets in the crowd. So the ballad singer is up at the front performing and holding everyone's attention. Meanwhile, his mate is kind of wandering through the crowd, cutting purses and draining people of their money. I mean, who knows how often that happened, but it's a staple of a ballad singer on the stage, that when a ballad singer is represented fictionally, usually he, very occasionally she, is kind of criminally minded. So they had a bad reputation. It's a little bit like sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's kind of the person who's itinerant, who travels around and isn't pinned down to a particular parish at a time when sort of staying close to your parish, especially if you were poor, was very important. That person is frightening. And then more generally, anyone who performs for a living, you know, they tend to be creatures of the night playing in alehouses. Music is notoriously difficult to police because you can say things in music that aren't kind of explicit, but they're powerful. And so in all sorts of ways, ballad singers had a very kind of dodgy reputation. But clearly some of them were very, very talented at what they did.
Just want to pick up on one thing you said earlier, Christopher. You said you mentioned that you sort of implied that there were female ballad singers as well. And obviously some of the tracks that you recorded are by female singers. Was that actually the case? Were there many female singers?
Yes, there were. I mean, I guess most of the names we have, and we don't have many names, are male names. But clearly, I mean, it's sometimes said that female ballad singers aren't really there until the sort of later part of the 17th century. I don't think that's true. I think they're there all the way. They're all the way through. They're just not maybe that well documented. But I actually think more broadly, the importance of women for the whole market for ballads is something which we've realised for quite a while, but I think it's growing in importance. I mean, I think lots and lots of these songs present kind of powerful, strong, virtuous women who are positive role models. They may be written by men, we can't be sure of that, but women were buying lots of these ballads. I think women were probably performing lots of these ballads. We know from various kinds of literary evidence that women clearly took these ballads home, memorized them, sung them. Milkmaids are often presented in plays or literature as kind of habitually singing ballads while they work. So I think women are tremendously important to the whole operation. And yes, there definitely were female ballad singers.
So there's one called, I cannot bring her surname to mind, so I'm really infuriated. She is the wife of a musician, and she's singing in Cheapside, where is all a big butcher's market, and she gets arrested because people, while they're listening to her, so she's so good, you know, that people are listening to her and people are stealing meat off the stalls. And so it's the butchers that all complain that when she comes round, then, I mean, they all lose meat. And as Chris says, some might say what she was connected with that, but actually she's from a musical couple. So actually you see quite a lot of these couples who both sing. So I think that's partly why we don't see so many women, but quite a few are arrested actually. So you get to see them then. But if it's a woman on her own, she'll often be arrested as a vagrant, you know, that's a imprisonment matter straight away. But it's interesting that as you're moving into the 30s and the 1630s and 40s, that they start to say that this is a ballad singer. And because I think they get treated slightly differently because of that. But there's also women involved in the trade. So there's some key producers. One of them is Elizabeth Andrews, for example, in the middle of the century. And she's a really remarkable figure. First of all, her husband dies, who's a publisher, leaving her with three children and an apprentice. She manages to get through that, keeps on with her business. And then she's burned out in the fire of 1666, gets together with another woman who's a printer, carries on producing songs and so on. And then finally, friends in the trade buy her out so that she can retire as they buy up all her title. So she was a great find, you know, discovering her.
Is there a song you'd like to listen to that was either written for a woman or sung by a woman that we know of and we can listen to?
Yeah, I can pick one. I absolutely love the one about the woman who kept her father alive when he was imprisoned by breastfeeding him through the bars of his cell. It's an ancient Roman story, often called Roman charity. So it comes from the very ancient period in Rome. But it's a fascinating song because it's a feisty, assertive, heroic woman who intervenes to kind of save her father. So the emperor says, this man is being imprisoned for an unnamed offence. We're going to starve him to death. No one's allowed to bring him any food. If he has any visitors, search them, see if they've got any food. If they've got any food, confiscate it. So she turns up daily and feeds him through the bars of the cell, keeps him alive. And it all ends happily because in the end, the emperor decides, when he realizes what's happened, that she's been brilliant and she's been a devoted daughter, and therefore the father's released and they get rewards. But I like it because it's simultaneously a tremendously kind of traditional matriarchal image with the breast and the milk as the provision thing. But at the same time, the woman is using this for quite subversive purposes to defy the emperor. So it kind of does all of that. And I think it's a fantastic song as well.
Okay, we'll listen to a little bit of that.
The emperor granted her request conditionally that she, each time she to her father came, should thoroughly search it be. No bread, no meat with her she brought to help him there distressed, but every day she nourished him with her most tender breast. Thus by her milk he was preserved a 12-month and a day, and was most fair and fat to see, yet no man knew which way. The emperor musing much thereat at length.
The woodcuts on those are amazing. I came across a 19th century one that had been published in Dublin in about 1830, and it's kind of like, you know, it's really very explicit what's going on, and you just kind of can't quite imagine this being acceptable.
It's interesting you mentioned the woodcuts. That's another thing I wanted to kind of come on to. In the text on the site, you mentioned that these are kind of early comic strips, really. Tell us a little bit more about that and the importance of having these images alongside the ballads.
Well, I think for a kind of semi-literate audience, the pictures must have been extremely important. And the way it seems to have worked, if you had a ballad as a publisher that you weren't entirely sure was a hit, you kind of recycled images that already existed. So lots of these songs, we don't exactly know who makes these decisions, the publisher or the printer. What they did was look at the woodblocks that they had already and then try to find images that kind of fitted the story. And that's where you get this idea of the comic strip, because they clearly do just try to tell the story in a very kind of simple way by positioning kind of three or four woodcuts. Often there are kind of incongruous details that are left in because the pictures were designed for something else. But they're clearly kind of working to try and make the pictures fit a story. But then if you had a hit on your hands and you knew it and you were confident about it, what you might do is commission a special woodcut picture that actually did illustrate the song in a much more what we would regard as a sort of conventional way. So, for example, the ballad about Titus and Andronicus has a fabulous kind of woodcut with little bits of the story designed. So you get kind of general woodcuts being kind of recycled, but then you also get specially commissioned woodcuts that do illustrate the story. The decision to kind of commission a special woodcut is actually a kind of marker of the success of the song, because you don't generally do that unless you're pretty confident that the song's going well, because it's quite expensive to commission a new picture. So yeah, it's a fascinating area.
And just to finish us up, I have to ask you, what was number one in your list? And we'll play out with that, I think.
Okay, yeah, number one is a sort of remake of the ancient story of Dido and Aeneas, kind of tragic love story set to a catchy little tune. And it clearly shows the fascination with history, that it was so popular for so long, but a combination of history, and it also kind of, it's got romance in there, it's got tragedy in there. So it kind of ticks all these boxes for themes that clearly were extremely successful at the time.
And like one being in a trance, a multitude of ugly fiends about this woeful prince did dance. No help he had of any friends. His body then they took away, and no man knew his dying day.
That was Christopher Marsh, Professor of Cultural History at Queen's University Belfast, and Dr. Angela McShane, Honorary Reader in History at the University of Warwick. The musical clips that you heard in this episode were recorded and performed especially for the 100 Ballads Project by Andy Watts and the Carnival Band, with invited singers from the worlds of folk and early music. For more information on the project, the musicians, and to listen to more 17th century ballads, visit 100ballads.org. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.